coloring the satellites in dark colors so they won't reflect as much light. But it's usually, you know, when it comes down to Starlink satellite, because there are so many of them, not really just the Starlink, but there are other satellites that affect a lot of our scientific research, and constantly, so we keep track of all these space debris in our database, and then we keep reporting to different space agencies. But there is very little we can do, even as a research group. What we can do is advocate and provide them with data of how much space debris we have in our low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit.
So there is methods of advocacy, but as yet, we've yet to see a change in that direction.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not the best note to end on, but...
No. No, but, you know, even talking about this is also important, right? So people are actually aware that how polluted our night sky actually has become over the years. And the more satellites we launch, the more debris there will be in our low Earth orbit. But again, at the same time, when people go out in the middle of nowhere or even just out of city limits and look at the night sky, it's still fascinating and it's still extremely active, and it always will be active. And there are lots and lots of things which are happening in the universe constantly, and a lot of undiscovered things that we don't even know that exist. And we may never know answers to some of the astrophysical phenomenon.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Speaking to CFIR Radio 88.7 FM, the FIR is president of the Prince George Astronomical Society, Malhar Kendekar, explaining the nighttime phenomena witnessed on May 5th, 2026, across our relative latitude from here to as far of parts as Saskatchewan, and right here in Prince George, Claylie-Tanay, the jellyfish effect, which looked kind of like a space ghost.
Yeah, it did. It definitely did.
Thank you so much for your time explaining that phenomena and the further phenomena of how we as human beings are affecting the nighttime sky.
Thank you for having me.
Much appreciated. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CFIR Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
This is Bird Note. With today's mobile apps and sound libraries, it's never been easier to listen to birds on demand. But that wasn't always the case. Back in the 1920s, Cornell ornithology professor Arthur Allen wanted to help his students learn bird calls in the classroom. But back then, bird recordings were practically non-existent. Fortunately, this was the era of the first talking films, and a prominent production company enlisted Arthur's help to jazz up their movies with bird recordings. Arthur and the production team hauled their clunky gear to the woods near Cayuga Lake, but the noisy equipment kept scaring away the birds. Eventually, it occurred to Arthur to put just the microphone near a perch popular with song sparrows and leave the rest of the gear out of view. In the dawn hours of May 18th, 1929, a little brown bird made history. That day, Arthur and his team recorded a song sparrow, house wren, and rose-breasted grosbeak. With today's high-tech recording tools, bioacoustics researchers can eavesdrop on whales underwater, bats in the air, and more than 11,000 bird species found around the world. And it all started with a song sparrow. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Joining me now for Gardening with Embark is Pablo Vimas, our gardens expert from Embark Sustainability. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What is it, week So deep into the year.
Yeah, we are week 21.
Wow.
The long weekend is coming.
Yeah.
And that is where the officially in Vancouver we started the gardening season.
Yeah.
So we've been recording every week since we start the year. Yeah, it's week 21. And yeah, we are now focusing on week 26, 27,
yeah,
when we will start our nursery for the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Summer hasn't started yet.
But we're already thinking of the fall.
So with this long weekend, many of our gardeners, local gardeners, will be visiting the garden centers and getting their summer crops, mm-hmm, mainly tomatoes, peppers, aubergines or eggplants. So now we are in the middle of late spring, so we are sure that the temperature is going to be warm enough at night. We are not expecting any snow unless there is extremely climate change.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now we are very safe to have all our crops outside. We also been harvesting all our spring crops.
Mm-hmm.
So if we started our lettuces early in the season, planting in April, by now they are ready to harvest.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening in our garden here in the Student Union. We've been planting with a spring gardening cohort, and now we are just harvesting. So it's awesome to have at the end of this season what nice produce to taste.
It doesn't take that all that long. You know, I mean, it seems like just the other day putting seedlings in the ground, and here we are, food on the table
is because I think the good weather that we had at the beginning of the month, so that really encourages the plants to develop. So some of the pak choys are in flower, so we realized we need to harvest those. The romaine lettuces, they are lovely growing, and as well we will be harvesting soon and sharing with the SFU community. As we harvest, there is little things that they are not edible. So we have some yellow leaves, some stems. In the past, we've been talking about composting in a regular way, just piling up and leaving there to decompose, adding brown materials. But there is another way to compost. There is vermicompost using earthworms, the regular red wigglers that we know. And this have a different way to manage. So we just can have our greens. We chop.
Yep.
We add a bit of browns, and we add the red wigglers in there. And the red wigglers do all the work in transforming the greens into nice crumbly soil or crumbly earthworm poop, as we say. But when we use earthworms, we have to be careful what we add to our composter.
Right, because, of course, it's food for them.
It's food for them, so they don't like onions. That's one of the things that they don't like, onions. So they are very sensitive to onions, they don't like it. Then we can add eggshells. Yes, we can add eggshells.
Yep.
We can add a bit of lime as well for them to help. And we try, if you are doing at home, do not add anything that is dairy, like cheese, milk, or anything, our salad that has a dressing, because earthworms are very sensitive to vinegar.
Right.
So they are very sensitive. So that's something that we use vinegar, cotton bud with vinegar, to show people how sensitive the earthworms. If you put a cotton bud with vinegar in front of the earthworm go towards that and they backstack like it's not this.
Yeah.
So they don't like it. So, So if we are doing our lovely composting using earthworms, make sure that you don't add onions, you don't want lemon peels or orange peels is another thing that they
anything
don't like.
Is too acidic or, sharp.
And no dairy and no anything with dressing with vinegar. And having a compost, a vermicompost, is awesome because you can adding, and every time you add your material, you just make sure that you chop. So it's nice to say, I'm making a salad for the earthworms,
right.
Because you're chopping all the materials, and the more area there is, they're just enjoying it. And as And every time you keep adding, and a few weeks you will be harvesting all that precious compost. Yeah.
Now, I had a friend many years ago, because of course, usually when you think about composting, you know, you have a big sort of bin and you know, lots of material, and you, like you say, you throw, you know, your plant waste in there, and then you maybe throw some dirt and some other stuff to sort of get it all going. But it's a pretty big operation, so to speak. Yep. And I had a friend who was really into gardening, but she lived in an apartment. Yep. And so she did this composting with the worms, because it was actually something that you can do on your patio.
Yes. Yeah.
And I guess because you're being... It's smaller in scale, but also you're being much more careful about what you put in there. It's sort of cleaner, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, I mean, compost is, in fact, clean, but not necessarily your apartment patio clean.
Yeah, so there is a DIY system. Like, you can have two Rubbermaid tubs, one inside the other, and one collects all the liquids that drain from the composting process that we tend to call compost tea. That as well can be diluted and added to the plants as a nutrient.
Oh.
So it's nutrients that are just liquid, and everything is contained. It has to be under a roof. It cannot be open in the open.
Yeah.
This DIY composter, because we had in the garden, and it was everything working lovely until we had a rainstorm.
Yeah.
And everything flooded. And then I had to rescue the earworms because the worm compost bin was flooded. So so the earworms were on top of the compost.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing that we realized. It has to be undercover. If there is no undercover, we put a tarp. But our garden was too open. Any tarp that we put just blew away. Mm. And, that is the real. So, yeah, it's easy to build these DIYs. Make sure that one composter has lots of drain holes, so all the water drains, and you have other containers to collect all that drainage that can be used for your plants.
So, when you're doing this, does it have sort of a kind of cycle of it where you start it, you put stuff in it, and then at some point it's ready to be put into your. Or is it something that's sort of a continuous process?
It's a continuous process. The thing is that you have a layer of compost and with earworms. As the earworms eat your fresh material, you have to keep adding. And they keep moving up. And they reach a point that you have filled your compost, your bin, and then you have to put another bin on top with fresh material so the earworms can move into that.
Right.
So it's all a system that you stack until you can... The earworms all have moved to the new fresh material, and you have the old bin with the casts, with the earworm casts for collection. Yeah, so it's interesting. It keeps you daily, frequently checking your compost, and it's a way to process, do composting in a small space like in a flat, but as well in the garden, as long as there is a bit of cover.
Right. Excellent. Very interesting to see all the different alternatives that exist.
Yeah. Besides the regular compost that we can get in the garden centers, or even the City of Burnaby offers a regular compost that you can go and get it at a lower price. But you also can get your earworms. Here in Burnaby, we have the Red Wigglers Burnaby. So it's worth checking their website, where you can buy your earworms.
Right.
So, because they are not everywhere. These red wigglers, they have a specific diet. They like fresh food.
Right.
You cannot just dig it up from the ground. And if you see an earworm coming out after a rain from the ground, that won't have the same diet. So you cannot pick it up and put in your composter, because that doesn't have the diet, so that most likely will die. The same like our red wigglers putting in the garden bed, they will die because they are not used to that environment. So
once you get it started, is something you can just keep going ongoing year round, as long as it doesn't get too cold.
Yes,
I guess.
When they get cold, they get a bit lethargic. They don't move much, but they still need to eat.
Yeah.
So the thing is, on winter, when there is nothing growing in the garden, we still need to feed them.
Yeah.
And that's when we have lots of leaves from the that we collected during the fall, the dead leaves, we keep adding those to our earthworms. And now and then, when there is something green coming from the garden, we keep adding. So that's all the
And some of your vegetable kitchen scraps, as long, yes. again, as long as you say, as they're not having dressing or other sort of things mm-hmm. on them. But, you know, like when you make a salad, often you peel the outside leaves yeah. and all that
yes,
stuff is,
all that
can
stuff
go in there.
Goes there. Yeah. So, yeah. So in the garden itself, is a challenge over the winter because there is nothing to feed them. Yeah. So we already sometimes have to think, pile as much as they so they can survive. Yeah. The beautiful is when you go in the spring and you open your composter, there is tiny little earthworms, white earthworms. They are the baby ones, white. They have to be white, very, very small. And they love to nest on the stems of broccoli and cauliflower. Yeah. Somehow those stems get very spongy, yeah. and the earthworms lay their eggs in there, and they're nice environment for the babies.
Excellent. So interesting. Thanks so much, Pablo.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to share.
Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability, our weekly gardens expert. Tell us more how to find out more about Embark.
Embark is a non-profit organization that we work on food justice and climate equity. Part of the food justice is our programs gardening, like learning cohorts, the learning gardens, and the food rescue that we are going to start next week. So everybody, if you are close by the Sawe Well Hall, come around afternoon, after 12 o'clock, and visit our table. We will have produce ready for you to share. And as well, you can visit our website at embarksustainability.org or our social media at embarksustainability.
Great. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, have an awesome long weekend and enjoy it. Bye.
Enjoy.
Hey, I'm DJ Coco.
And I'm DJ Star.
Come join us for Slumber Party, Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
You'll hear female artists, oversharing, and research on health, psychology, and identity.
Hope to see you there.
So, Peter R.H., you are...
I went
on an adventure this week.
Well, it was, wasn't that adventurous. It was at SFU downtown.
Yeah.
They have sporadic meetings. This was about the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm. Like the current situation going on?
It was also, the person wrote a book, and I forget the person's name in the book, but it was from that perspective. If he wasn't born in the area, he was certainly of that background as such. What sort of at issue now is the Gulf of Hormuz.
Hormuz?
Hormuz, yes. Okay, Gulf of Hormuz. Now, I saw some other posting. They said a lot of people are saying, well, they're breaking international law. They're not allowing people in. But the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Hormuz is not really international waters. In fact, there's also a organization that of people around the Persian Gulf. It's called the Gulf Cooperation Council.
So was this the speaker series, the Persian Gulf is a waterway and a region? Is that the one you were at?
Yeah, that's what I went to. It was also one of the things they were bringing up is like geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And that's more of people trying to control certain regions. It's like... There is, geography, but geopolitics, the speaker said, that's mainly where people want to control things in their own way. And that's sort of what has been happening there, obviously. And there was something I didn't know about called the Carter Doctrine. And it started in January 23rd, 1980. The U.S. would use military force if necessary to defend its national interests in the Persian Gulf.
Thinking about the dates, that would have been Jimmy Carter's last year in office.
Yes, the beginning of the last year.
Yeah.
And I think that was before the hostage crisis, too, or wasn't it?
Mm.
No, 1979 was
it the... It started. I don't think it...
Yeah.
It would have been during the hostage crisis.
Yeah, so
because it wasn't resolved till...
That's right, that's
practically
right.
Practically the election time in 1980.
But anyway, so that region, they want to control it. The United States wants to control everything. They want to control the world under Donald Trump.
And, of course, part of its geopolitical importance is, of course, it's where so much of the oil from the Middle East comes from. And that, in the current crisis, why the closing of the Straits of Hormuz is such a big deal, because 20% of the world's oil flows out of the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, the other thing, I was looking at something else on the internet about the Gulf of Hormuz, and there's a lot of accusations about Iran, like they're breaking international law and so on. And from the point of view of this posting, they were saying, well, it's really Israel and the United States are breaking a lot of international law. Yeah. They're not made to account for it. And also, the fees they're asking is helping Iran, according to this posting, dealing with all the sanctions and so on that they're having to deal with. I mean, not that it's such a great regime, but it's like Trump did. It was insane what he did. It was just, I guess he thought he was successful with Venezuela, the way he handled himself. He thought he could handle it again, and he was wrong.
Very much so. And the war goes on. You know, it's interesting because I saw a comment about the agreement that they had in place, which was put in place by Obama and continued through most of the first Trump administration, to put in a inspection regime on the Iranian nuclear program that, from what I've read, was one of the most intrusive and exacting inspection regimes ever put in place. And that, you know, it was nearly impossible for the Iranians to do anything secretive because, you know, international inspectors, not necessarily Americans, but international from the International Atomic Energy Agency, had such access. So in the problem was kind of contained. And then Trump, in his hubris, and probably just more than anything upset that this was something Obama put in place and therefore had to be ditched. And, of course, in his own sort of exaggerated opinion of himself, felt he could do better.
That was the first term he rolled back on that.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of saying it was Obama. Because, yeah, as you're saying, it seems that it was an okay agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And there was control over that.
And now, of course, he started this war, which he can't figure how to finish because he can't figure out how to come out seeming to have actually accomplished something with the Iranians. And the Iranians, they just have to endure as they have. And there doesn't seem to be a way for the Americans to compel the Iranians, as it turns out, to do what they want them to do. And they thought they could just toss some bombs around and get them to comply. And it turns out the world isn't that simple.
The other thing, I don't like how he wants us, Canada, involved in it. He wants European countries, who he continually insults. And they say, I want you involved. And if you're not involved, why aren't you involved? Well, because you don't treat us nice to begin.
And it was a bad idea.
It was a bad idea. The other thing, the error he made was that just because you killed the supreme leader, he's really the honorary leader. I guess what it is is that's to present that they go by the Islamic faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the countries run by a certain civil service or a...
They have a public civil service bureaucracy that seems to function well and properly. They even have elections and stuff. It's just, you know, the ruling religious order and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps hold the real power in the country. But a lot of the daily running of stuff is through elected officials. But, you know, you mentioned about how, you know, he thought he could just take out the supreme leader and that would... Because, you know, based on the success of Venezuela, but even in Venezuela, they took out Maduro, removed him from the country, and the next people in line within the existing regime just stepped up one level. It's essentially the same regime with a new leader. They're a little more compliant than they were before.
Well, he's always doing something.
They didn't get and it was not entirely reasonable to think that Iran would work the same way.
No, one thing I learned at the meeting was that there's something called the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Yep.
And that has... I don't think Iran's part of that. The countries that are part of that are, oh my goodness. The membership is Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. There's one that starts with a B here.
Bahrain?
But interesting, Iran's not part of it. But this organization, they attempted to have a common currency that sort of fell through. But so there's a lot of people having trying to have the region have some coherence with the region, but it's very. One time I had some plumbing trouble where I was living. And it was like...
Where are you going with this story?
No, it's just that I thought I had it fixed because I thought, oh, we just do this thing. And it worked for a while, but then that wasn't the major problem with it. Then I found out the idea of plumbing is water pressure to get it fight gravity. Yeah. But the thing is, that's sort of what Trump did. He sort of had a superficial... He said he could superficially do it. That was the same thing with the plumbing problem.
And he unfortunately found out, as we all are, because we're all feeling the effects of
more,
this war, that
higher,
the problem is much more complicated than he thought it was.
Higher oil, petroleum prices. Then the thing that I keep bringing up, this was 2.5 years ago. I did something on the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, and the United States and other countries were part of oisting him out in favor of the Shah. And the Shah was there for about 20 years or 25 years, and we've gotten the mess we've had now. I mean, one of the tragedies I really feel is that prime minister, he was sort of a moderate. Mm-hmm. We really would have more of a, not quite a secularization in Iran, but we would have had a more moderate outlook of the people there, not an extremist.
It's quite possible, because he got knocked off. The Shah came in. The Shah pushed a lot of sort of secularization and westernization policies, which is part of what made more traditional Islamists unhappy, which to a certain extent powered the Islamic Revolution, because it becomes a reaction of people being, you know, and who knows what would have happened with a more moderate path.
Well, actually, he wasn't killed, that prime minister. He was placed in solitary confinement for 2 years, and he lived a bit on afterwards, which is sort of tragic, because he was doing his best. It was actually interesting that the Labour government in England, before Winston Churchill came back, was basically owned part of what became BP. It had some other name, British Petroleum. Yeah. The government owned about 50%, and they were taxing the other thing of it. So they were getting that funds for, you could say, for trying to do a welfare state in England. And then once Churchill got in, once Eisenhower got in, they just crucified the poor man because they just wanted to have the region so controlled. And, of course, it backfired at the end because there's so much trouble in that region. Partly, well, it's also kind of what they imagine Iran. Like you're saying, they had a good deal. They were keeping tabs on them. There was no way they were going to have the atomic weaponry.
Yeah.
I don't even think they really want one. They sort of just people want it for the threat of it. They don't really want it in a sense.
Well, of course, one reason they want it is because they're constantly being threatened, and perhaps they hope that having one will give them a sort of trump card, so to speak, to keep everyone else from bugging them. You know, it's one of those action reactions. I mean, you know, someone does something, someone reacts, and then people react to the reaction with a new action, and you escalate problems.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really go for their extremism. I'm not going to agree with that. But Dubai is that if you're a citizen there, I think Saudi Arabia is the same thing. You get the money. The people that do the real work get farmed in. There was one example I saw where this guy came from Italy to do some hotel work. And they kept his passport. And they kind of blackmailed him when he wanted to leave. They said, well, you're going to get somebody else.
Yeah.
And so the other guy gets in trouble if he doesn't come back. So they blackmail you. They got really bad situations with how the labor is done.
For the most part, none of those countries are really great. So how do you want to wrap this up?
Oh, just in the middle of nowhere, like everything else is. So it's wrapped up now.
All right. Thanks. That's our show. We'll see you next week.
On the next Alternative Radio, hear Chalmers Johnson on Blowback, the consequences of U.S. foreign policy. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 4, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Hi. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.